Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. On April 25th, 2014, today's guest, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, watched the news as Flint, Michigan Mayor Dane Walling pressed a button at the Flint Water Treatment Plant to shut off the valve to close the Detroit water supply. From that moment, Flint residents started getting their drinking water from the Flint River. Mayor Walling celebrated the occasion by drinking a glass of the water. Unbeknownst to the public, the new water supply was contaminated with high levels of lead. Almost immediately, residents complained about the color and the smell of the water coming out of their faucets, but city and state officials told people that everything was fine. After 2 years of denial and thousands of sick people, the tireless work of activists, scientists, doctors, local journalists, and engineers uncovered a scandal. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha played a major role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. Her tireless research revealed that the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels increased after the water switch. In her new book, What the Eyes Don't See, a story of crisis, resistance, and hope in an American city, she writes, quote, "This is a story of a government poisoning its own citizens and then lying about it. It's a story about what happens when the very people responsible for keeping us safe care more about money and power than they care about us or our children." End quote. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine and Director of the Pediatric Residency Program at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint, Michigan. She has testified twice before the U.S. Congress, and Dr. Mona joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
It's great to be here, Rose.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much for writing this book. So many of us listened to you, read about you, and it was interesting to learn more about your history, about why you became a doctor, and then also to learn about what went on behind the scenes and to connect all the dots. As you sit here today on book tour, how are you feeling right now when as it all is sinking in?
Well, you know, I started writing this book over 2 years ago, and I knew that I wanted a way to shine a spotlight back on Flint. I knew even back then that our story would not be over, that we would still have long-term issues that needed to be addressed. So that's kind of why I started writing this book and what brings me here today to share it with you. The lessons of Flint are tragic. It was a man-made disaster, the most important environmental and public health disaster, arguably, of this young century. But this book is more than just about Flint because it is about the deeper crises that are all over our nation right now. And it's about the activism and the resistance, the collective teamwork that uncovered this crisis. And it delivers a story of hope. And that is something that we all need right now.
Your family is from Iraq. You're an immigrant. When you wrote about the water switch, you said that you really believed in the system. You thought that people in lab coats would be testing the water. Of course, why wouldn't you? Why would you question this in the United States? Did you ever think that you'd be fighting for clean access to water?
Absolutely not. So when I wrote this book, I wanted to share, you know, what happened in Flint. But I never thought as a pediatrician that I would write a book. I never thought that I would uncover this crisis. But these lessons need to be shared. I wanted to dare our readers to hear about something that happened here on American soil, that a population, a city of poor minority people in the middle of the Great Lakes, in the middle of the largest source of fresh water, did not have access to safe drinking water. So that is definitely one of the points of this book, is for people to be in disbelief. And I was never a naive, you know, I didn't naively believe everything that government told me, but who doesn't believe that when you turn on your water, that it's not safe to drink? This is America. Mm. This is the 21st century. We have rules and regulations and people who, this is their job to protect our public health.
How are people in Flint doing today?
That's a great question. So the people of Flint are incredible. They are brave. They are resilient. They are proud. They are loyal. And they have turned this crisis around. So to this day in Flint, we are still on bottled water and filtered water because our pipes are being being replaced. Our pipes were severely corroded because of the 18 months on this corrosive untreated water. So our pipes are being replaced, and we're only the third city now in the nation that is going to be replacing our lead pipes. So that's a huge accomplishment, and we're doing it in less time than any other city. But the people of Flint are still struggling with the daily obstacle of access and affordability of safe drinking water.
Who's paying for the bottled water at this point?
That's a great question, too. So up until about a month ago, bottled water was being delivered and provided for by the state. And they ended that about a month ago. However, there are still filters that are available for the next 2 years.
Why did they end it?
Because the testing in the water in Flint had improved dramatically. So we do have much lower lead in water tests. It meets all guidelines. However, that's not why people still need to be on bottled water and filtered water. It is because of that infrastructure work. Whenever you do earth-moving infrastructure work, you disrupt the lead scale that's underneath. And that's the reason why people still need to be on that bottled water until or filtered water until their pipes are replaced.
So Flint is the third city in the country that will replace lead pipes. This is a pretty big undertaking, I assume.
Massive. Yeah. Only other two other cities, Lansing, Michigan and Madison, Wisconsin, are the only two other cities that have replaced their lead service lines, their lead pipes. And it took them over a decade.
Wow. A decade.
Yep.
How many other cities need to do this? Do you know?
Lots of cities, especially in the Northeast and Midwest. So as a nation, we were very slow to restrict lead in our plumbing. Not until 1986 did we restrict lead in our service lines, which are the main lines that go from our water main to our house. But lead was used in plumbing inside fixtures and faucets. So not until 2014 did we restrict lead from our brass fixtures. So there is lead in really everybody's plumbing.
And who is making sure that the tests are happening the way they should?
Yeah, so currently there's a lot of independent third-party verification. Some of that is being done by the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, which filed a lawsuit that mandated the pipe replacement. So they have been authorized to do a lot of that third-party testing. There's also other academics, as well as the EPA and the State Water Quality Department that is doing that testing right now.
You have so much interesting information in your book about lead and the history of lead. You write, "I know lead. All pediatricians know lead. It's a powerful, well-studied neurotoxin that disrupts brain development. There is truly no safe level."
Absolutely. So when a pediatrician hears the word lead, we freak out. We know what it does. We've learned so much about it, especially in the last few decades. Levels that we thought were okay decades ago when we had lead in paint and lead in gasoline, we know are not okay. And we know that there is no safe level. And we know that even the very lowest levels can impact children's cognition and behavior and really alter their entire life course trajectory. And what's the most damning thing about lead is that it's a form of environmental injustice. Our kids in Flint already had higher lead levels, just like kids in Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia and D.C., some of our country's most vulnerable children who are already suffering with so many obstacles to their development are burdened with this preventable environmental exposure.
You have just amazing scenes in the book in which mothers, parents come into your office and ask about the safety of the water. And at this point, you didn't have all of this information. And you said, of course, the water is fine. Keep drinking it. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. So that part of writing this book was reliving those stories and those encounters with patients. And I was reassuring my patients, because who didn't expect when the state says something's okay, it's okay. So moms were asking me if they could bathe their babies in this water. Of course you can bathe your babies. They were asking me if they could feed their newborns formula mixed with this water. Of course I said it was okay. I said, this is America. That's not 19th century London cholera epidemic time. Like, it's the water. How can the water not be safe? So I very much believed, I very much had my eyes closed to what was going on.
There are about 10,000 kids under the age of six in Flint, and many are your patients. What do the studies tell us about what we can expect as these kids grow older?
Sure. So we very much know what lead does at a population level. Great work in the field of epidemiology has told us that. It impacts cognition. So the IQ curve shifts to the left. You have more kids who need special education services, less gifted children. It impacts behavior, causes things like attention deficit disorder, developmental delays, and it can really alter a child's entire life course. However, we are not waiting for those consequences. And that is very much what this book and this story is sharing. It is a story of hope and recovery. We have built a model public health program leaning on the incredible science of child development, of resilience, to not see those consequences. And professionally and ethically and morally, we had to do everything we could to not see those consequences. So in Flint now, we are doing things that aren't being done anywhere in this country. We've doubled the capacity of home visiting programs, early literacy programs, breastfeeding support services, child care, near universal preschool, Medicaid expansion, mobile grocery stores, nutrition support, WIC expansion. All of these things are science-based interventions that we know promote children's development, and we are throwing everything at our kids. And in a very much of an academic sense, as an academic, we are assessing this work. We've launched a Flint registry that will enable us to see how people are doing, so I can very objectively, in a data-driven way, tell you how Flint kids are doing.
How did activists accomplish that? I mean, at a time when we're all wondering what's next in this country, what is most effective, I mean, the list that you just went over is very comprehensive. These services are needed in every city across
Absolutely.
This country.
And that's part of the message, is that this is stuff that we should be doing for every single child, not just Flint kids. And part of our work is to make sure that we share our best practices with other communities, and so that they have the ability and the access to implement these and to assess them. It was a part of the reason that we made this happen was a lot of education and advocacy and activism. So when the water crisis struck, we were flooded with water bottles. Water crisis, you need water. It took a lot of education to share with folks that, yeah, you know, the water is great. We're grateful for that. But the treatment for this is investing in children. There is no magic pill for lead. I can't take it away, but we can do everything we can to buffer, to limit, to mitigate the impact of this crisis with these child-supporting interventions.
And are a lot of these interventions fairly new, or have they just been expanded?
A combination of both. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we did have some home visiting programs, but we doubled the capacity of that. Some of our early literacy programs are brand new. In places like Flint, we have a deficit of words and of books. There's about one book for every 300 children. By the time our children reach the age of three, they've heard 30 million less words. This is national data. So we have done massive investments to combat that. Now in Flint, every single kid gets a book in the mail every month from the age of 0 to 5. We've expanded a program called Reach Out and Read, which from one clinic to 10 clinics in Flint that deliver books to children during their primary care visits. At birth now, we have a program called Born to Read, where every baby born at the hospital gets a bundle of books. They get signed up for these programs and they get developmental resources. So a lot of these programs are brand new. A lot of these programs are expanded, and it's all with a combination of state, federal, but mainly philanthropic support. One of the reasons that I wrote this book was to give back, to give to our Flint Kids Fund. Right after the crisis struck, we created this Flint Kids Fund to support the development of our children for the next 20 years. And part of the proceeds of this book goes back to this fund.
You write that studies show that kids who are exposed to lead can have violent tendencies when they're older. And so I was thinking, how is the system going to support these people as they grow older, especially those who don't have access to health care or these services? What happens if, for example, they're 15 and in high school and something just clicks and they need a lot of therapy and they need a lot of medical support?
Yeah. So once again, we are hoping not to see those consequences because of the proactive and positive interventions we are putting into place now. But we are working very closely with our school partners, practicing something called trauma-informed care, recognizing that this is a trauma that has happened in our city, not just the lead exposure, but really the trauma of the crisis, the trauma of the betrayal, the stress, the anxiety, the guilt, and all of those things, all of those stresses can lead to complications and chronic diseases.
This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, who is you don't live in Flint, but you're a pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, lives right outside. And Dr. Mona played a major role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. And she's out with a new book called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Let's talk a little bit about when you first started learning about what was happening. Ellen, who is a very dear friend of yours, is an environmental engineer who moved back to the Detroit area after many years in Washington. And you were spending time together, and she asked you, what are you hearing about the Flint water? And you write that the question surprised you, as did the abrupt shift in Ellen's demeanor. Her eyes were boring into yours. You said, I've heard the complaints, but the state says it's fine in compliance. And she said, no, it's really not. And that's what started all of this.
Absolutely. So Elin is an incredible water scientist. She worked at the EPA about a decade ago when in Washington, D.C., when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis. So she was over at my house, last minute barbecue, and asked me about the water in Flint. And like you said, I was telling her that everything was okay. And she's the one that told me that the water wasn't being treated properly with corrosion control. And I had no idea what that was. So I asked, I'm like, what's corrosion control? And she's like, without corrosion control, there is going to be lead in the water. And until that point, I did not even know that our plumbing was made out of lead. I had no idea. And that's how blind I was. And then later to learn that the word lead actually comes from the word plumbing. The elemental symbol for lead is PB from the Latin plumbum, because lead was always used in plumbing. And I had no idea. And this is coming from a pediatrician with an environmental health, public health background who's taking care of dozens, if not hundreds, of children with lead exposure.
To back up a little bit, let's talk about why the drinking supply was switched, why Mayor Dane Walling pressed a button at the Flint Water Treatment Plant to shut off the valve to close the Detroit water supply and then ensure that Flint residents got their water from the Flint River. So again, this is such good information, because we all heard about these emergency managers, but it's easy to kind of forget why this all happened. So as you write, in 2011, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder declared that nearly bankrupt Flint was in a state of local government financial emergency and appointed an unelected emergency manager to run the city, which takes all real power away from the mayor.
Absolutely. So the Flint story is a democracy story. And that's why it should also resonate nationally right now, because there are lots of communities where democracy is being lost because of voter disenfranchisement and gerrymandering. But Flint essentially had democracy usurped from them. In 2011, the governor just came in and said, we're going to appoint a state, you know, an emergency manager, and their only job was austerity. It was to save money no matter what the cost. And the emergency manager decided that the water that we had been getting for half a century from the Great Lakes was too expensive. And to save money, we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline to the Great Lakes was to be built. So this was all under the auspices of austerity.
And it wasn't just Flint. Snyder also appointed EMs, emergency managers, in Detroit and Pontiac. And by 2013, half of all African-American citizens in Michigan were living under an emergency manager, compared with just 2% of white residents.
Grossly undemocratic and essentially racist.
So let's talk a little bit more about how this decision was made. Did the citizens have any say in any of this? Did the media cover this decision?
The media covered the decision. You know, after the water switch happened, the city council actually voted and said, hey, we want to go back to Flint, to the Great Lakes water. But the emergency manager said, no, that's too expensive. So there was no accountability. There was no role for elected officials, locally elected officials. The state was making all the shots.
And then you also point out that the water bills in Flint were very, very expensive. When a city doesn't generate enough tax revenue because property taxes don't bring in enough money, the poor people who live there are punished with much higher utility bills.
And this is the greatest crime. The people of Flint were paying the highest water rates in the country during this crisis. Before we were a crisis of quality, water quality, we were a crisis and continue to be a crisis of affordability. People were losing their homes because they could not pay for water. The United Nations actually got involved in both Detroit and Flint because of all the shutoffs happening, because people did not have access to water, a basic human right.
I mean, it's amazing to read this. The average annual Flint residential water bill in 2015 was $864, about $300 more than in any other city in Michigan. And as you say, the highest in the nation.
Highest in the nation. And Rose, this is probably the poorest city in the nation. We have a 60% poverty rate for our children. Our families have every struggle to make ends meet, let alone to be able to pay for water. And get this, we are literally in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. 20% of the fresh water in the world is around Michigan and is around Flint. Yet we have a population of people who are predominantly poor and predominantly minority who could not access that.
And the population right now is just under about 100,000 people?
Yes.
With a 60% poverty rate?
For children. It's about a 58% poverty rate for children.
What else do we need to know about Flint?
So a lot of this book goes into the history of Flint and the history of many things, because we cannot function in our society today without knowing what we are stepping over. So for me, and kind of one of my values and important kind of objectives in life is to know the history of things, because we very much tend to repeat our mistakes, mm-hmm. and we don't understand how we got into the situation. So you'll learn a lot about Flint history, and it is incredible. Flint is the birthplace of General Motors, the birthplace of manufacturing, but also the birthplace of resistance. Auto workers led something called the historic sit-down strikes that really birthed the middle class. It birthed the labor movement in the auto industry, and it created the UAW. And that arguably created something called the Grand Bargain, where people got benefits and pensions and great schools and great infrastructure. And at one point, people of Flint made the highest per capita income in the nation, which is so hard to believe. And because of that, had some of the best public health indices in the nation. So Flint, from its beginnings, has been a place of extremes, really, where greed met prosperity, where a lot of our race relations have played out. You know, from that prosperity, Flint has been subsequently in crisis for decades. Flint is a story where where General Motors abandoned its birthplace. We see that in Roger and Me, Michael Moore's movie. But it's a place that has suffered from disinvestment, unemployment, poverty, racism, lots of greed that led to blockbusting and redlining that left the city starved at its core and essentially segregated and really set it up for this crisis.
There's also an incredible immigration story in Michigan and the Detroit area. Your parents are Iraqi. You were not born in Iraq, but your brother was. And your dad was actually hired as an engineer to work for General Motors.
Right. So everybody in Michigan is one degree of separation away from the auto company. Mm-hmm. So my father worked for General Motors for over 30 years as an engineer, a metallurgical engineer, grew up with the metals and periodic table throughout my life. But everybody is very much tied into the auto industry. And Michigan has the greatest population of Arab Americans. They came initially to work for Henry Ford and have continued to come. The most common second language in Michigan is Arabic.
And you write about how you've always wanted to be a doctor and you immediately fell in love with Flint.
Yeah, Flint. I came to Flint as a medical student. So I went to medical school at Michigan State University, which is the first community-based medical school. So you do your clinical training in a community. And I did my clinical training in Flint, and that is where I fell in love with the city. I fell in love with the people, the proud, loyal, really steel-plated resilience of the people of Flint. And I also fell in love with the discipline of pediatrics. Pediatrics, to me, was an ultimate form of kind of prevention. Everything we do in pediatrics is preventative. It's a mix of clinical care, a mix of public health, and very much a mix of advocacy. Mm. We are, as pediatricians, we are the voice of children. We speak up for children, and we must, unless we get kids to vote, which I think we need to do.
Well, and it was so interesting just to read about the first community-based medical school in 1964, MSU, and the medical school's motto is service to people.
Absolutely. And that's why I went to medical school there, because of their primary care orientation and their commitment to the underserved.
And I also love how when you bring in residents, you go on a walking tour of Flint and you teach them about the history of where they're about to work.
Absolutely. So I direct a rotation called Community Pediatrics, which is for pediatric residents. So after you finish medical school, you have to do residency training in a certain specialty. So pediatric training is another 3 years of training. So medical education never ends. And my goal for these residents is to get them out of the hospital, to widen their lens, for them to see what they usually don't see. Doctors are notoriously myopic. We just see what's in front of us. We see a kid come to the ER with an acute ingestion. We treat it. We send them home. We fail to ask about how they're living. Do they have, you know, do they have food on the table? Do they have safe places to play? When my doctors start their training, I kind of lower their egos. I'm like, what you do in medicine contributes to only 15% of health outcomes. It's all that other stuff, from poverty to the environment, to the social situation, to incarcerated parents, to violence on the streets. These things have a bigger impact on the lives of children, and we need to be involved in those things.
And that speaks to the title of your book, What the Eyes Don't See.
What the eyes don't see. So it means many things. It quite literally means lead in water. We do not see lead in water. Mm-hmm. It's invisible. It's odorless. It's tasteless. We also do not see the effects of lead. It's known as a silent pediatric epidemic. We don't see the consequences for years, if not decades. And then it's really hard to even prove causation. But fundamentally, this title is about more than Flint. It is about the people and the places and the problems that we choose not to see all over this country. But the lesson of this book is that we have the power within us, no matter who we are, where we are, what we do, or how long we've been in this country, to open our eyes, to see, and to not only be awake, but to get involved and to envision a world, especially for our children, that is better than what we have right now.
How did this affect the new doctors that you work with?
A lot of them were involved in the uncovering of this crisis.
Right.
We had many involved in the research, in the interventions, in the water delivery programs, in the literacy programs. Our clinic is really kind of one of the central spots where a lot of these things are happening, and those residents and medical students are involved in all of them. So we have always been a residency program where we embody the social aspects and the public health integration. And I think our residents are now able to see that firsthand. People go into medicine because they want to help people. They want to make a difference. But medical education and training and your career in medicine and research shows people get jaded throughout that training. And they forget why they went into medicine. And this book is a reminder really for all of the reason that you went into medicine, and that you really do have a credible voice in your community, and that it is up to us to use that voice, to work hand in hand with our community to improve outcomes.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha. She played a major role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. Her new book is What the Eyes Don't See, a story of crisis, resistance, and hope in an American city. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and this is a pre-tape conversation with Dr. Mona, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Coming up after the break, we will find out what happened when Dr. Mona started doing research and asking questions about what was happening to the water and lead levels, specifically when it comes to children. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha. If you paid close attention to what was happening in Flint, and we did a lot of shows about it, you saw Dr. Mona in the news, you read about all of the work that she did. She played a major role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. And just to give you some background and to remind you, on April 25th, 2014, then Flint, Michigan Mayor Dane Walling pressed a button at the Flint Water Treatment Plant to shut off the valve to close the Detroit water supply. And from that moment on, Flint residents started getting their water from the Flint River. Almost immediately, residents complained about the smell of the water and the color of the water, but city and state officials said, everything's fine, keep drinking it. Dr. Mona is out with a new book, What the Eyes Don't See, a story of crisis, resistance, and hope in an American city. All right, let's talk about what happened after your friend Elin, the environmental engineer who moved back to the Detroit area after many years in D.C., asked you about the water. You had many long nights doing research, looking at news reports, and wondering, how did I miss this?
Right. So there was obviously quite a bit of guilt because I had been telling my patients that everything was okay. But there was no going back. Once I had heard the word lead, it really became a choiceless choice. I had to move forward. I had to prove the impact. I had to see if that lead in the water was getting into the bodies of our children. So we conducted this research in record pace, which really the book goes through, to see if we had elevated lead levels in our kids. And what we found was not surprising, because by then we had learned really the basic science. We had learned, for example, that General Motors stopped using this water because it was corroding engine parts.
Okay, that was amazing to learn about. I forgot. So GM stopped using the water.
And this was just a few months into the water switch. So in October of 2014, a few months into the water switch, General Motors stopped using this water in their plants because it was corroding engine parts, and they got a bypass back to the Great Lakes. And that should have ended there. The crisis should have ended there. That's when like alarm bells should have gone off everywhere in the city and the state and said, hold on, pause. If it's corroding engine parts, what is it doing to our aging infrastructure that has lead in it?
And so why didn't that happen? I mean, if they got a waiver to go back to the Great Lakes as their water source, and you quote this GM spokesperson, quote, you don't want the higher chloride water to result in corrosion. We noticed it some time ago, end quote.
It is unreal. It is mind-boggling why that did not end the crisis. There were so many missed opportunities. There were so many red flags. It never should have gotten to the point of me. Like, I consider myself the last domino in this story. It never, ever should have gotten to the point where there needed to be proof of its impact on children. It should have stopped when that first mom said, there's something wrong with my water. There's something wrong with my child. It should have stopped when General Motors stopped using this water because it was corroding engine parts. It should have stopped when water scientists were sharing that there was lead in the water. It should have stopped when the EPA scientists said there's lead in the water. There was many, many points in the story where it should have stopped.
I mean, it's shocking when you learning more about the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the statements that spokesperson put out, lack of action from the EPA. You sent so many public health officials emails and you were waiting thinking, okay, it's Monday morning. They're going to write me back immediately and something's going to be done. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, no responses.
I don't know how people slept at night. Like, I stopped sleeping. I stopped eating. I stopped sleeping. I was obsessed. You do not mess around with lead and you do not mess around with children. This is water that you're talking about. Water is meant for ingestion. I literally did not know how people could go to bed knowing this information.
Give us a snapshot of what happened in Washington, D.C., because when your friend Elin talked about the lead crisis there, you said you hadn't heard about it, and I hadn't either.
Yeah. So about a decade ago, Washington, D.C. switched their form of disinfectant. They went from chlorine to something called chloramine, and that made the water more corrosive, and they had no idea. So the corrosive water went through Washington, D.C.'s distribution system, which also had a lot of lead in their plumbing, in their pipes, and in the interior homes. And that resulted in elevated lead levels in the water. For years, much longer than Flint and in levels even much higher than Flint. At that time, Mark Edwards, a scientist from Virginia Tech, was brought in to study why the copper pipes were leaking. And out of curiosity, he tested for lead in the water and he found elevated lead in the water. And it took him years for the government to admit that there was lead in the water in Washington, D.C., and there was massive cover-up by so many agencies. Nobody in Washington, D.C. was held accountable to this day because of that lead in water crisis.
To this day?
To this day.
And then we haven't obviously learned anything from it.
Obviously. And Washington, D.C. wasn't even the first lead and water crisis. So because I was not sleeping during this period, I started to read a lot about lead and water, which I knew very little about. And I read a book called The Great Lead Water Pipe Disaster. And it talks about 150 years of lead and water disasters. Right when we started putting it in our plumbing, we started seeing problems. There's actually theories that the demise of the Romans is because they used so much lead in their plumbing. Mm-hmm. They also put it in their food, which was really weird. But there's stories upon stories of lead and water disasters. My birthplace is Sheffield, England. They had a lead and water disaster in the 1890s, and they noticed that many pregnant moms miscarried. They lost their babies. So because of that, one of the first abortion pills was developed in the early 1900s, which was a lead pill. And there's articles about it in the British Medical Journal. So we have known about lead and water for quite some time, yet we've failed to learn from history, and we failed to have the political will to eliminate this exposure from our children.
Today, we're speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, who played an instrumental role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. And she's out with a new book called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. And this is a pre-taped Your Call One Planet series, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Before talking about Mark Edwards, let's talk a little bit about Detroit investigative reporter Kurt Guyette, who had been assigned to cover the emergency manager story for the Michigan chapter of the ACLU with funding from the Ford Foundation. Now, I had to read that sentence twice. I thought, oh, a journalist is writing an article for the ACLU. That's interesting.
It's such serendipity. So he is a seasoned investigative reporter who was hired by the ACLU with funding from the Ford Foundation because they were worried about the consequences of emergency management. What can happen to a state when you lose democracy? So he was on the ground and he was digging and digging and digging. And thank God for him and the other investigative journalists.
He had been a skeptic about the water source switch all along.
Absolutely. And he kept asking questions, kept pushing, kept trying to get information.
Now, in July 2015, he posted a news story on the ACLU blog and Deadline Detroit, releasing a memo, an 8-page interim report written by Miguel del Toro, Elon, your friend, Elon's former colleague and the regulations manager of the Midwest Water Division of the EPA.
Right. So that's really when the story broke. So he was given from a mom this memo from an EPA official that very clearly said that Flint had a lead and water issue. So it broke in July of 2015. That should have ended the crisis. It was public. There was lead in the water. And nothing happened after that.
And yet the memo, the subject line, high lead levels in Flint, Michigan.
Done. Like, end, period. That's it. That should have called in, you know, the National Guard. That's when the state should have asked for federal help. The EPA should have gotten more involved. I mean, this is very clear.
I mean, there's so many specific examples, but we'll just talk about one. Del Toro's report described water testing in the home of Leanne Walters, a 37-year-old mom of four and a military spouse who lived on Flint's south side. A few months after the water switch in 2014, she noticed her 3-year-old twins, Gavin and Garrett, broke out in red bumps after they were given a bath. Gavin had immune deficiencies and was prone to problems. If he soaked in the bathtub for a long time, a scaly rash would form across his chest at the water line. And even after the city lifted its boil alerts and officially announced that the bacterial content in the water was in compliance with the guidelines, the family continued to experience rashes. They had abdominal pain and bizarre hair loss. Her eyelashes started disappearing.
Unbelievable. And I don't know. There was so much in this water. It's hard to say what caused it. Was it the bacteria? Was it the chlorine? Was it the high level of the disinfectant byproducts? You know, there was a toxic soup in this water. And the skin manifestations were some of the first that were seen.
So after this memo, again, high lead levels in Flint, Michigan, was released, Governor Rick Snyder's office issued a statement that the Flint system was producing water that met all the state and federal standards.
So it was all about being in compliance. It was all about rubber stamping, permits. It had nothing to do with public health. And the being in compliance, we later found, was because they failed to include some of the high lead water samples. So they threw out high levels so that they could be in compliance. They also, the testing was also done in a way that was faulty to minimize the capture of lead in water.
So they would turn the faucet on and let the water run for a while?
Right.
So, and then grab the sample?
Yeah, there's several things that are done, not just in Flint, but all over the nation, to minimize the capture of lead in water so that public water utilities don't have to do more work like replace lead pipes. One thing is pre-flushing. So run your water and then we'll collect a sample. But that's not how we drink water. Or run it at a lower speed or, you know, lower flow rate, or they vary the mouth of the collection bottle. All these things change how much lead is captured in the water.
Talk about the steps you took to try to gather as much data as you could about lead levels in children.
Sure. So back in the day, we used to screen all children for lead levels. However, in the last few decades, the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels has been coming down because of great policies. We got lead out of paint. We got lead out of gasoline. We have more home mitigation efforts. So every year, the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels nationally has been coming down. And because of that, doctors no longer do universal screening. We don't check every patient at the ages of 1 and 2 for lead. But we are supposed to do that for high-risk populations. For example, children on Medicaid, because Medicaid serves as a proxy for poverty. So kids on Medicaid are supposed to get their lead checked. And we check lead levels at the ages of 1 and 2 because that's developmentally when a child is crawling, walking, has a lot of hand-to-mouth activity, when they are at risk for household lead exposure, like lead paint, lead dust, and lead soil. And I want to bring home that age of lead screening is not when you're most at risk for lead in water. Lead in water impacts a younger and a more developmentally vulnerable age group, especially those babies on formula. And lead in blood has a very short detection window, something called a half-life of 28 days. So all the blood data, my research, the other research that validated our data, was an underestimation of exposure because children were not being screened enough and they were not being screened at the right ages. So because lead has no symptoms, our eyes don't see lead poisoning, especially the subclinical poisoning, the lower levels, we screen for it. And when we detect it in a child, all it does is tell us that there's a problem in the environment. It's backwards. We are using children as environmental detectors of lead exposure. But that's unfortunately how it is right now. And when we detect in a child, we then investigate their environment, what's going on. Because one doctor can't see all the patients in a community, there's already surveillance programs at the county health department and the state health department that looks at this big data, like what's happening over a population in terms of blood lead levels. We also have surveillance programs, for example, for flu and for HIV and for other things that we need to see with trends over time. So there's people whose job is to look at blood lead levels in communities and to see what's happening. So I first tried to get that surveillance data from these health departments and had roadblocks in every direction. And then it turned out that our hospital sees the most kind of Flint kids. We actually processed the labs for most of the children in our county. So we pulled the records from our hospital data and ran the numbers because we couldn't get the numbers from anywhere else.
And when you published your results, it's amazing that you hit so many roadblocks. I remember one woman at a public health department said she was going to email you some results, and you waited and the days went by and the email never came. So you said that you started doubting yourself, and you wrote, quote, "I worried that I'd thrown everything away on a hunch. I worried that the results weren't peer-reviewed. I worried that I was in way over my head. And most of all, I worried that I was doing exactly what the state accused me of, creating a problem where none existed and adding anxiety to the already stressed lives of my patients in our city."
Yeah. So when I shared this research, I was attacked just like everybody else in the story was attacked, just like the moms and the pastors and the journalists and the water scientists. My science was attacked. My credibility was attacked. And how can you not believe that? The whole state is attacking you. You know, maybe I was wrong. And they actually had that larger data set. So they said my numbers were not consistent with their numbers. And there's nothing that can prepare you for those feelings of doubting yourself and of really embarrassing yourself and putting, you know, children in harm's way.
When you look back at all of those attacks, especially when you think about the state that we're in right now, people are wondering, how do we get out of this? What's next?
Yeah.
When you have the forces against you for trying to protect children.
Right. And that's why I wrote this book. And that's why this book is relevant for everybody, everywhere. It is about being resistant, especially in these political times. It is about being an activist. It is about building a team of a village of folks around you to fight for what is right. So yeah, I was attacked, but I was lifted up by my village. We were fighting for what was right. And that's not always easy. That is hard. But when you can build a collaborative group of folks who also support you and believe in you, ultimately, we succeeded.
What did you learn about how the system works in all of this?
Yeah, you know, I've learned a lot of lessons and things I already kind of knew and valued. So I learned of the value of science. So ultimately, it was science that spoke truth to power. It was numbers and it was facts and it was evidence that you know, felled this house of cards. I also learned the value of working closely with media partners. Mm-hmm. There was, finally the state conceded. But, you know, did they concede because of the facts, or did they concede because the media had gotten so involved at that point? So, you know, you in pediatrics, I lived in my silo, and I thought, and I hung out with other pediatricians, and I didn't think anybody else cared as much about kids besides pediatricians. Like, we have a monopoly on caring for children, right? But no, so like you have to work with people who you don't usually work with. You have to break down silos. So it was journalists and water experts and activists and moms and pastors. And it was this really diverse team of folks that did this work. And I think that was one of the lessons, is that it takes a team to do this work. And so often we think we are alone in these fights, but we're not alone. There are people who value the same things that you do, and that's one of the biggest lessons of this book.
Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha played an instrumental role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint's children. Dr. Mona is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine and Director of the Pediatric Residency Program at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint, Michigan. And her new book is What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Let's talk a little bit about Mark Edwards. You mentioned him earlier, specifically around the work he did in D.C. He also came to Flint. He's a corrosion expert for Virginia Tech.
Right. He is probably one of the world's leading experts on lead in water and corrosion in water. And when he found out that Flint had lead in water and that the state wasn't doing anything about it, he literally packed his minivan overnight with graduate students and with supplies, and he drove up to Flint to work hand in hand with the citizens, to use citizen science to prove that there was lead in water. They scientifically sampled the entire city, very transparently posted their results, their water lead level results. And he helped, you know, and he was instrumental in providing that data and that science that there was lead in the water.
At what point did government officials start to acknowledge this issue? Because, I mean, you've got a number of quotes that are just kind of shocking from agencies like the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. You're thinking, do you believe what you're saying? Why not just tackle this issue, apologize, say you did the wrong thing, and change it rather than lie to the public about this?
So there's been many reports written about like what happened and what went wrong. And one of the reports actually said, if the State Department of Environmental Quality actually spent more time investigating the problem than attacking people, you know, this would have been solved. Mm-hmm. So they were just on attack mode. It was deny, deny, deny for as long as possible.
And where are these specific people now?
So a lot of these people have lost their jobs. So at the state, the spokesperson for the Department of Environmental Quality was fired. The director of that department was also fired. Lots of criminal charges have been brought against many folks in this story. The head of the EPA Region 5 resigned. Many people have lost their jobs and many people have been criminally charged. We talked a lot about lead and water. We also had one of the largest outbreaks of Legionnaire's disease, which is a pneumonia that older people get also because of this untreated corrosive water. 12 people died. So we actually also have negligent homicide charges brought up against people. There's lots of efforts at accountability, and that accountability is so incredibly important for the people of Flint. I think of it like a truth and reconciliation process. We need to know that truth. We need to get at what happened, and then there's a role for restorative justice, and then we can get into that long process of reconciliation.
What about the role of the EPA at the national level and the Obama administration?
Yeah, so this happened during the Obama administration.
Right.
And the amazing Miguel Del Toro, this EPA scientist, was silenced. He was a whistleblower who was silenced. Because of that, his administrator no longer had a job. So the EPA also had their own report, their inspector general, that disclosed that they should have acted 7 months sooner. They should have done more because they knew. And as a result, Congress passed something called an EPA notification bill, which says that when EPA knows about a lead and water issue, they have to alert the public. And it's kind of mind-boggling that we need a law to do that, but now we have it.
After your press conference, I mean, Governor Rick Snyder eventually apologized. He named 5 men to a Flint water task force, and you write that you were very skeptical at first for obvious reasons, but the report was damning. It stated clearly that the demographics of a community, race, had played a role in creating this crisis. It stated race had kept the crisis going long after it should have stopped, and they explicitly connected the Flint water crisis to the emergency manager law.
Absolutely. So this was an incredible report done very early on that called out the role of environmental injustice. This is not a new field. Mm-hmm. This is not the first time we've had an environmental injustice. These stories happen throughout our nation and increasingly so, where people who are poor, people who are predominantly minority, disproportionately suffer from environmental burdens. And it was made very clear that what happened in Flint was started and exacerbated by the demographics of the population.
Mm-hmm. Because we wouldn't see something like this in San Francisco.
Absolutely. We would not see this in many Michigan communities that are whiter or richer.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book. And I'm so glad you came to the studio, because it's looking at you. I just remember seeing you on the news regularly, watching the videos and just thinking, I cannot believe they're attacking this woman. And what is going to happen next?
Well, they messed with the wrong woman.
They messed with the wrong woman. Yes. Thank you so much
for
coming in.
Thank you so much, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha is out with a new book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. She played a major role in uncovering elevated lead blood levels in Flint. Dr. Mona is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine and Director of the Pediatric Residency Program at Hurley Children's Hospital. And you can find more information about her work at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.